this juncture, the responsible course of action for us to follow is to take a pause and to assess where we are.
The Anchorage mayor puts the city's massive software project on hold. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, August 13th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the university works to define consent when it comes to sexual conduct.
Why not start with verbal? Because verbal is the most common way we make agreements for anything.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
A massive software project that's run millions of dollars and years over original expectations was halted today by Anchorage's new mayor. As KSKA's Zechariah Hughes reports, the move is meant to re-examine the city's path forward, but it won't totally shut off money for the project.
Implementing the SAP software across the municipality's offices is, to put it mildly, a pretty giant mess. There are a lot of unflattering numbers associated with the program's overruns. When former Mayor Dan Sullivan's administration announced the project in 2011, it was forecast to cost around $11 million and take just a year and a half to come online. But Assemblymember L.V. Gray Jackson ran through a much different timeline at the start of a committee meeting.
September 2014, project now 2 years behind schedule. Budget is $31.4 million, tripling the projected cost.
Currently, it costs the city around $50,000 a day to pay for employees, consultants, and office space, all without a clear end date. So, Mayor Ethan Berkowitz announced his administration has decided to take what he's calling a pause.
And at this juncture, the responsible course of action for us to follow is to take a pause and to assess where we are, make a determination about what options we're going to have moving ahead.
The length of that pause has yet to be determined. It'll cost the city several $100,000 just shutting down current operations. That is, paying consultants as their jobs wind down, keeping up with rent payments, and other obligations. No city employees will lose work. They'll all be reassigned internally. This is the third time the SAP project has been put on hold. And Assemblymember Amy Domboski, who was critical of the last administration's spending on the project, reminded the new administration that the longer the pause, the more costly it is to resume operations down the line. Asked whether full termination was a possibility, Berkowitz replied,
"We're going to be reviewing all options."
The administration has recruited a team of seven Alaskans, mostly from the private sector, to review the project. In Anchorage, I'm Zechariah Hughes.
The University of Alaska system has defined consent for the first time when it comes to sexual misconduct. The definition is in the university's new student code of conduct, which is the basis of university disciplinary proceedings. One expert calls the definition good, but thinks it could go further. KTOO's Lisa Fu has more.
In the University of Alaska's updated student code of conduct,
consent is defined as being clear, knowing, and voluntary, and can be withdrawn at any time. It's defined as being active, not passive, and cannot be given while an individual is incapacitated.
Michael Vitava is Director of Student Conduct and Ethical Development for the University of Alaska Anchorage. He was part of the working group that established the definition.
Past consent does not imply future consent, and that silence or an absence of resistance cannot be interpreted as consent.
It can be words or actions that create mutually understandable, clear permission.
So in other words, UA is not requiring a verbal yes.
Vitava gives this example.
If there were two parties that were involved in a romantic encounter, and one party, started removing their clothes and started motioning with their finger for the other party to come towards them, had a smile on their face, that's, in my mind, I think a reasonable person would argue that that was a form of nonverbal consent.
Mandy Cole wonders,
why not start with verbal? Because verbal is the most common way we make agreements for anything.
Cole is deputy director of AWARE, Juneau's domestic abuse and sexual assault prevention nonprofit.
What I would like to see and what I think is kind of a best practice is that we get more used to getting verbal consent and that we get more used to saying the words, do you want to have sex with me? Because honestly, if you feel comfortable enough to have sex with somebody, you should be comfortable enough to say the words.
Cole says UA's definition of consent has the necessary elements. Other higher education institutions like the State University of New York, Northwestern University, and University of California have similar language defining consent as either words or actions. Cole says it's difficult to require a verbal agreement, but she'd like society to move in that direction.
It's kind of a new thing, really. When I went to college, no one said a word to me about consent. Certainly no one ever said a word to me about getting verbal consent before sexual contact. So I think this is developing.
One company, Consent Game Changers, has gone beyond verbal by selling consent kits. Each pouch comes with a contract card, breath mints, and a condom. The company's website says the contract gives both parties the confidence of a documented consensual encounter, or to at least remind you to have the consent conversation. Cole says she's happy UA has defined the term and is part of a national conversation, even if it was prompted by an increasing number of sexual assault reports in colleges. More than a year ago, the U.S. Department of Education put UA on a list of about 60 colleges nationwide being investigated as part of a compliance review or for mishandling sexual assault complaints. That list is now at about 130. Cole says advancing the conversation about consent keeps people safer and more prepared to discuss sexuality.
So that we don't continue propagating this idea that sex is about power. So if we talk about sex being more about consent and agreements, and it's freely and knowingly decided by both people, then it takes away some of that, the old kind of thinking about what is legal and what's not legal.
Cole says it's more about what's right. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
Authorities have arrested the former computer network manager at the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation, who is accused of possessing and distributing child pornography. An Anchorage grand jury indicted Gene Gessler Wednesday, and authorities said in the afternoon that the man's whereabouts were unknown after he had fled the state. He was arrested Wednesday evening around 9:30 p.m. in Goose Creek, South Carolina, and booked in the Berkeley County Jail. He's held on a $200,000 bail. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Southeast Alaska's smallest city turns 40.
Our official population is 24.
I thought it was 25.
I live 25.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. Increase the earning power with a Bachelor of Business Administration degree with a human resource management emphasis from the UAS School of Management. Details at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by UAS.
70 years ago this month, the U.S. dropped two atomic bombs on Japan, prompting its surrender and the end of World War II. Now the two nations' armed forces are collaborating in Alaska. As part of the Alaskan Command's Red Flag exercises this summer, two dozen Japanese paratroopers are training with Army soldiers based at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson. After 10 days of exercises, the groups flew north in cargo planes before jumping into the Donnelly Training Area near Fort Greely. It's not the first time the Japanese Ground Self-Defense Force have partnered with Alaskan troops. Lieutenant Colonel Alan Brown says in the past, soldiers have gone through cold weather training at the Army's Black Rapids site.
The airborne capability is something that Japan has been developing in recent years. Our first experience with it recently is jumping with them over in Japan as part of an exercise this February.
Brown says the goal is building a firmer partnership with one of the U.S.'s most important Pacific allies.
The deeper the foundation, the more readily we'll be able to integrate with them in an emergency situation, a contingency like a human disaster, where we need to assist in concert with that country for recovery operations or search and rescue, those types of things.
The U.S. is increasingly shifting its military focus to the Pacific. Training exercises with partners like Japan, Australia, and others are seen as a way to build multinational capacity and are also a form of deterrence for other regional powers like China and Russia. According to the Army, yesterday's jump was a success with no reports of injuries. Asked whether the timing of the training had anything to do with commemorating historical events from World War II, Brown said there was no correlation. The Anchorage Assembly is trying again to add sexual orientation and gender identity to the city's anti-discrimination ordinances. Assemblymember Bill Evans filed the amendments today. They also include exemptions for religious organizations and say that no person should be forced to participate in an event that conflicts with sincerely held religious beliefs. Another provision says that people will be required to use restrooms and locker rooms appropriate to their gender presentation, regardless of their assigned sex at birth. The Assembly will take public comments on the ordinances on September 15th. Previous attempts to pass a similar ordinance were vetoed by former Mayor Dan Sullivan and rejected by voters. There will not be a vote this October for Bethel to go into local option status and pursue opening a city-run liquor store. The Bethel City Council, by a vote of 5-1, rejected sending the vote to citizens. KYUK's Ben Matheson has more.
Councilmember Chuck Herman cast the only vote in support, citing the ability for more local control and abilities for partnering with villages that are possible with a version of local option.
We can work together with them as a community and figure out what regulations and restrictions they need so that we are not just providing this massive space for importation to flow straight down the river. This would be a medium that I personally think would be the best for the Delta as a whole. The city would be able to, people in the city would be able to purchase alcohol from the store. They would not feel like a criminal going into the city-run store.
Bethel left local option in 2009, and citizens voted again in 2010 to stay out while still rejecting local sales. That developed a liquor status that allows for unlimited imports and no local sales. Vice Mayor Leif Albertson says that's agreeable for many.
That was something that a lot of people felt like they could live with. Moving forward, we don't really know what the state's going to allow us to do. And I think for many of us, before we would make a drastic, what I would consider a drastic decision to move back into local option, it'd be important to know what our options are. And I think we would have a better idea of that after an advisory vote, after we hear back from the ABC board.
The city is seeking an appeal of the state liquor board's rejection of their formal protest of Bethel Spirits application, a subsidiary of the Bethel Native Corporation, which is pushing for the first liquor store in Bethel in four decades. The Alaska Commercial Company is also applying to open a liquor store. Among the many moving pieces, the council will send Councilmember Zach Fansler to the next ABC board meeting in September in Kotzebue. The board will be holding a hearing in Bethel in October. That's the same month as the advisory vote. On the same ballot, Bethel voters will decide whether to tax future marijuana sales at 15%. The council passed an amendment to raise it from 12 to 15% tax. Mayor Rick Robb opposed the higher rate.
We are in danger of driving a legal product to an illegal product. And instead of getting 15%, we get 0%. And we also continue with crime and the associated economic crime that comes with illegal drug crime.
The council could lower it in the future without putting it to citizens in a public election. Leading up to Alaska's first legal marijuana sales in 2016, municipalities have options for regulating the commercial industry. And there will be local option provisions that could opt Bethel out of local sales or manufacturing, but the city hasn't taken any of those up. The city could also implement an excise tax, which doesn't need to be approved by voters. The council also established a marijuana advisory committee to run from September of this year to the start of 2017. That panel is tasked with making marijuana recommendations to the council. In Bethel, I'm Ben Matheson,
It's been widely accepted in the science community that melting permafrost means more carbon in the atmosphere, but a new study has just identified a quirk in that process. KSKA's Monica Gokey has more.
Permafrost is a layer of subsurface soil that stays frozen year-round. And it's generally understood that melting permafrost in the north means more methane and carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, which are bad for global warming. But a new study published in Nature suggests that some of the carbon stored in permafrost meets its bitter end like bootstrap Bill Turner in Pirates of the Caribbean.
And last we saw of old Bill Turner, he was sinking to the crushing black oblivion of Davy Jones' locker.
In other words, it gets buried at the bottom of the ocean. Dr. Valier Galli of the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution is one of the study's authors.
The burial of permafrost carbon in marine sediments offshore the river is something that that matters in terms of fluxes when it's taken for several thousands of years.
Down in Davy Jones's locker, that carbon is sequestered. It becomes a carbon sink as opposed to a carbon source. And it's in a format that won't contribute to climate change or ocean acidification.
As long as the permafrost carbon reaches marine sediment and is being buried in marine sediments, it is stable. It is then stable for really long periods of time. We can be talking, hundreds of thousands of years, millions of years.
High-latitude rivers are the engines at work here. Dr. Galli and his colleagues did their study on the Mackenzie River in Canada.
So what we did is, we took samples in different places of the river system. We took samples offshore sediment core, and then we looked at the organic carbon concentrations, but also its composition using geochemical tools. And what this shows is that a lot of this carbon is actually pretty old and comes from the permafrost.
Finding those permafrost carbons offshore was somewhat of a surprise. It was previously understood that these carbons made their way back into the atmosphere when permafrost melted. And that's actually still the fate of the majority of the carbon stored in permafrost. But if you add up what's put to rest at sea, it's significant over a period of several thousand years. The Mackenzie is a massive river, and the study estimates that it buries more than 2 million metric tons of permafrost carbon per year. That makes the river an especially big driver of this process.
That's what's really unique with the Mackenzie. Mackenzie has very high physical erosion rates, and then that's what makes it very efficient at burying carbon, permafrost carbon at sea.
Dr. Galli says some version of this carbon burial process likely happens in most watersheds at high latitudes, but more so with big rivers, like Alaska's Yukon.
In the Yukon, the erosion, physical erosion rates are also pretty high. And it's pretty likely that we will find the same things that we've been finding in the Mackenzie system.
Even though some permafrost carbon is being cycled to the bottom of the ocean, it's a process that takes thousands of years, which is much slower than the rate at which greenhouse gases are being emitted. In Anchorage, I'm Monica Gokey.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
Broken hips and head injuries can have life-altering effects, especially for older adults. But no matter how old you are, it's important to be physically active to prevent injuries. Activity can also increase your and can be done at any age. Ask your healthcare provider about activities that will improve your health. Learn more about starting a new activity at injuryprevention.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Friday was the last children's story time at a Juno Library branch that's been in the Mendenhall Mall for more than 30 years. The days of checking out books and grabbing a slice of pizza are over because the branch is moving to a new location at the end of the month. KTOO's Elizabeth Jenkins has more.
One morning, Bear heard.
About 15 kids are sitting crisscross applesauce, listening to Amelia Jenkins read a picture book. She works at the Mendenhall Valley Library. Her audience is sometimes captive, sometimes not. But she knows how to handle the crowd.
Every week is different. There are some weeks when everybody just wants to sit on a lap and listen quietly, and there's other weeks like today when everybody just wants to do the hokey pokey for half an hour straight.
Kids can check out the books at the end of story time, which is exactly what library staff want. Left behind materials have to be transported to the new location, so patrons are encouraged to check out up to 40 books. You could check out all the Harry Potter, Game of Thrones, Hunger Games, and 50 Shades of Grey series, and you'd only be halfway.
I know we're in a library and we're supposed to be quiet, but is it okay if I ask you some questions?
Yes, this is a new age library. We talk here.
MJ Grandy is the Youth Services Librarian. She's worked for the library for 15 years and is excited about the new 20,000 square foot space at Diamond Park. It costs $14 million to build, paid for by a grant from the state, and a city sales tax. Another million was contributed by the Friends of the Juneau Public Libraries. Of all the perks, there's one Grandy says she's looking forward to the most.
Space. We are almost doubling our footage here, so the kids area and the kids programming is a really dominant part of the library, so we're going to have a lot more space in the new one.
There's also wheelchair-accessible reading nooks and a room that has its own teen advisory committee to decide function and decor. But probably the biggest difference is it won't be sandwiched between a restaurant and a tanning salon. Grandy says not too long ago, it wasn't uncommon to see a library in a mall.
You know, kind of in the 70s when malls were really getting established as a destination, a one-stop. You come in, you can do your shopping, you can do your library, you could do other business. That evolution in the role of malls in culture has changed.
For Letha Bethel, the old location has been convenient. She's a stay-at-home mom with two kids and another she watches during the day.
He's got a little green on his mouth.
Yeah, we eat the markers more than we color with them.
Hi.
She says the kids love dancing and singing at the reading circle, the toys in the children's section, and of course...
the books.
That's your favoriteest part?
They walk to the Minden Hall Mall on sunny days. And Bethel says she's sad the library will be closed for the next few months as it moves to its new location.
It'll be nice, though, that it'll be bigger, hopefully, and more space for them to run around. So they're excited to see it, and it's right next to the pool, so...
Oh, that's nice.
But will she check out 40 books?
For their sake, probably not, because I don't know if they'd last at our house.
Bethel says she might consider checking out one or two before the Mendenhall Valley Library closes on August 31st. It opens back up at Diamond Park sometime in November. In Juneau, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins.
Most people in Petersburg don't give much thought to the handful of houses which sit on the other shore of the Wrangell Narrows. But to the people who live there, it's a place they are proud to call home. Its name is Kuprinov, and it's Southeast's smallest and Alaska's second smallest city. This week, it turns 40. KFSK's Joe Sykes found a community still proud of their little piece of Alaskan independence.
When Sharon Sprague and her husband Dick moved to Sasby Island in the middle of the Wrangell Narrows in 1975, they had to build a life from scratch.
We started with nothing. There wasn't any water here, there was no electricity, nothing.
Since then, they've created what some might call a homestead. They have their own hydroelectric power system, chickens run around in the garden, and plump fruit hangs off trees ripe for picking.
These are cherries. They're just starting to come.
Here's a good tasty one right.
Delicious.
Go ahead, take them all.
They built this place to get away and live out on their own. And together with a group of other isolation-inclined individuals, they helped found the city of Kuprinov, the smallest city in southeast Alaska. It sits on the shore of Kuprinov Island, just next to the Sprague's house, and on the opposite side of the Narrows from Petersburg. It started when residents who lived on the island decided they were sick of Petersburg, and so organized themselves into an independent city. And the Sprague's went with them. And Sharon Sprague says Petersburg and Kuprinov are separate for a good reason.
The two communities are so opposite.
That opposition has boiled over in recent years when Kuprinov fought the establishment of the borough of Petersburg. They lost that battle, meaning they had to pay more money into Petersburg's coffers, but they retained their status as a city. And at a recent council meeting, jokes at Petersburg's expense flew over breakfast of watermelon slices, sausages, and eggs.
Has the assembly over there provided you with breakfast yet?
That's Tom Reinarts. He's Kuprinov's mayor, but he says in a city so small, the mayor is not just the mayor.
I'm also the police chief and the fire chief.
And everyone has to play a hand here. Butch Anderson's been living here for about 8 years. He turned up to the council meeting one day just to see what was going on.
There was an extra seat to open, so they voted. I got one vote. I got in by landslide, one vote.
He likes it here because he can kind of do what he wants.
I'm a hermit. Because I live alone and enjoying life. I don't like heat. My house, it'll get down to, I'd say 25 inside. Then I will light the fire.
They're idiosyncratic. They keep to themselves. And because of that, sometimes it's hard to remember just how many people actually live here.
Our official population is 24.
I thought it was 25. I read 25.
Oh, well, maybe 25. I can see.
24 or 25. Their six-member council makes up about a quarter of their population. And while they say they've not always seen eye to eye, they do have a common bête noire. The city of Petersburg. According to Butch Anderson, they're Petersburg's
red-headed stepchild. They're still, we want you guys to follow our rules. So we can tell you how to live your life over here.
So now it's their 40th anniversary, and they're determined to show Petersburg they're here. They've been here for a long time, and they are here to stay.
We need to make a big splash so that our friends across the bay, Petersburg East, and I say that, Joe, because the Petersburg folks call us Petersburg West.
They're proud to be Kuprinov, and they know with so few people, it will always be a struggle to survive. But Sharon Sprague, standing on her dock, looking out over both communities, has the answer.
If you've got a group of people and they have one goal and they all feel the same and they're a unit, they have strength.
What should the goal be going forward, do you think?
To keep it like it is. This is a jewel.
And it's a jewel that'll always be a bugbear to Petersburg.
They hate us. We're a thorn in their side. They just wish we'd go away. But we're not going to.
And if it was up to Sharon Sprague, they'd be a thorn in Petersburg's side for another 40 years to come. In Petersburg, I'm Joe Sykes.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Zachariah Hughes, Ann Hillman, and Monica Goki in Anchorage, Lisa Fu and Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau, Ben Matheson in Bethel, and Joe Sykes in Petersburg. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Goki is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence.
And by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. Alaska oil and gas have a huge impact on all of us, but how much do you really know about them? At akoilandgas.com, you can take an oil and gas IQ quiz and get the facts from reliable sources. This message sponsored by the Alaska Oil and Gas Association. Alaska Pacific University is still accepting applications for the fall 2015 semester for their Master of Business Administration program. APU offers personalized education grounded in hands-on, real-world experiences to prepare graduates to be leaders in their communities. More at 1-800-ALASKA-U or alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.